You are listening to a talk given at the Brisbane City Bible Forum. We hope you enjoy the presentation.
Well, welcome. It's great to have you here again as we consider more than power. My name's Glenn. If I haven't met you before, it's great to have you here. Explore the whole idea of power, its uses. Format's really simple, which is I'll speak for about 20 minutes. And then we'll open up for questions and comments and reflections and challenges. The City Bible Forum is the name of the organization and forum. We really actually want to engage with you, engage with what you're thinking and why you're thinking that, engage with your ideas. Well, let me start. Power is a good thing, right? I don't know about you, but I love power. I'm an ex-farm boy. So, yeah, I mean, if you're going to cut some wood, let's do it properly, baby, right? Now, why is power so good? Well, it just enables you to get more things done faster. All right, now I know that you're into power. I want you to just check your pockets and pull out your phone. Because has anyone still got one of these? See, no, you're into power. You're into that, aren't you? You're not into this. You like power as much as I do. It's just that you didn't grow up on a farm, right? And chainsaws don't fit in pockets. But it's the whole idea, isn't it? It enables you with all its kind of applications and convenience to get more things done. Let me show you one more thing, I think, in your modern life that you like power. Netflix, Stan Presto, or old school TV? What's your vote?
Netflix.
Netflix. Is anyone still voting for old school TV? A couple of people, right? But I think, what is it? You know, it's TV on demand. You get to control what you watch, when you watch, where you watch it. How you love power, Gemma, you power hungry dog. Now, there's many different types of power. You probably heard in the news, soft power, hard power, when they're talking about politics. Soft power, kind of influence, hard power. I've got great big rockets. You know, that's the difference between soft and hard power. Well, why do we want power? There's, you know, you look online, Wikipedia, there's articles and arguments, there's long drama about all different types of power. I want to ask, why do we want it? I think there's three main reasons. The first one is we want to get things done. We actually want to bend reality to our wills. And power enables you to do more bending. The more power you've got, the more you can bend, you know, just take the power tool. If you've got to drill a hole, you've got a power tool, you can drill more, you can put more holes in reality than before. The second reason we want power is in order to have influence or control over others. See if you can guess who this is. It might depend on my voice. My relationship to power and authority is that I'm all for it. People need somebody to watch over them. 95% of the people in the world need to be told what to do and how to behave. The governator. I don't know if I'd want to be in the state of California. Run away, right? But here's the third interesting thing that's come out. There was a fairly recent article in the Atlantic magazine, which I love. There's a bunch of studies. They cite a bunch of studies that actually say that people want to have power in order to have freedom or autonomy. So they want power not so much to be able to control others, but to be able to control themselves. To be able to have control over their life, their plot, their freedom. So they're the kind of three things that come out. Now, the question about power is about limit to authority. It's interesting, isn't it? I have a phone, I have authority over it, but if you're like me, your phone power is limited, isn't it? If you don't pay your bills, your phone stops working. There's limits on your power constantly. Legitimate use of power is related to authority. We're constantly asking this question. We don't even realize we're asking. We always ask this question. Does this person have the authority or right to wield the power in that way? It exists in the fabric of everyday relationships. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever been at work one day, working on something one morning, expecting to be working on X? The manager comes down through the open plan office. They're looking at you. You're trying not to look at them because you want to work on X. They walk up to you and say, I'd like you to work on Y. What do you do? You say, what do you say?
Why,
I skipper. Yeah, because in the office, you've actually recognized their authority, if they're a boss or a manager, and you've actually submitting to their authority, and they get to call the shapes on how you use your time and your energy. Even if you loved X or loved Y, their power changes what you do. Now, your boss's power is limited, right? You can free yourself from their rule. I just want to remind you that. You can free yourself from their rule because you can go and get another job. Or you can leave and be unemployed. But you can step outside that. Their power is limited. It's limited in another way, isn't it? It's related to scope. Let's just say you're driving down the road and you're at a set of lights down here on Ann Street and you discover that you're in a car next to your boss and they roll down their window and they say to you, pull over. How would you respond? Delicate question, isn't it? Because they're weird. Yeah, drive away really fast, right? No, especially if they pull out a blue light, right? Then I'm out of here, right? But it's interesting, isn't it? Because they have a certain influence or power of authority in the workplace. So they don't necessarily have power and authority on the road, do they? And yet, so at one level you can say, forget it. I'm out of here. But another level, yeah, you know that their power is limited out there, but relationships. Anyway, it's an interesting dynamic, isn't it? But if a random stranger said, pull over, you'd say, you have no power. You have no authority in this sphere. Power enables things to happen for ourselves, for others. We like it. It gives us freedom. It gives us control. It gives us the ability to get things done within certain limits. And we actually really like power exercised rightly. Craig Broman, he runs the City Bible Forum in Adelaide, talked about, you know, they had that power, all those, the winds knocked down all the power lines in Adelaide, and the whole city went into shutdown. And he said, he told me about a guy who, there was this, in one of the CBD intersections, massive intersection, everyone had realised the day is written off, everyone's trying to get out of the city, they don't know what's going on, and there's just cars, there's no lights, no the traffic signals work, there's too many situations, so the police can't get everywhere. And one guy standing on the side of the road, and then he just goes, walks out in the middle of the traffic, and then just starts directing traffic. All right, you stop. You go. Right, you stop. You go. Right, you stop. Pedestrians go. And everyone actually, what did they do? He assumed the mantle of power, but people conferred power on him. They gave it over to him because your other option, you could have just driven over the top of him. So you could have denied his claim to power. So it's interesting in the world, this dynamic of there's a call to power and a conferral of power. So whenever your boss says, do X, when you accept that power, you are actually affirming and confirming their power. So power is actually quite good. We like it. Kind of. Because here's the thing, and you know it, don't you? The very thing that makes power good is what makes power bad. That's the consuming question in the United States at the moment. Who should have power? Because when you vote for the person, that's ultimately what's happening in that election. You are choosing the person to have power over you. You are conferring on them, in the US, the right to have power over you. Now, there's limitations and checks and balances because of the problems with power. Frank Underwood from the TV series House of Cards captures nicely how we feel about political power. The road to power is paved with hypocrisy and casualties. I think that captures our ambiguity about power. You know, that's just a TV show about trying to become president of the United States, but it's accurate. We've all experienced power wielded for self-gain. LinkedIn. 48 ways managers abuse their power and destroy employee engagement. Anyone experience that? Don't worry, you're not on camera. Here's the first three. The way that bosses or managers, they periodically remind you that you can be fired. Just kidding. They humiliate you in front of others. To their team or their departments, they're yellow screamers or cursers. But when they get called on it, they say, everyone knows I don't mean it when I do that. And they never do it to anyone above them, do they? So remember these three reasons we want power. One, get things done, conform the world to your vision of reality. Two, control over others, which is intimately related so that they can do the things that you want done, or achieve freedom, or you might say control over your future. But I think these three are the three problems with power. Because whose things do you want to get done? Yeah, I want to get done my things, not your things, Aaron. And I want to achieve control or influence over to others. For whose good? Their good? Or my good? And I want to achieve freedom. But whose freedom? My freedom. And so many of the conflicts in our society come into that clash of whose freedom should prevail here. So there's not a problem with power, is there? There's a problem with who wields power and why they wield it. And the problem's so consistent that we're actually suspicious of power. A couple of weekends ago, there was a headline, Discrimination and Bullying. Oh, yeah, that's a normal headline. Where? Well, let me just read the first couple of lines of the article. A leading feminist has made official complaints of bullying and sexual discrimination against Tasmania's female anti-discrimination commissioner. No, what? Now, do you sit there when you hear that and think, no, it's not possible. Someone employed as an anti-discrimination commissioner and who's a lady, there could be no bullying or sexual discrimination in that. No. Do you think that? Or do you think, maybe? That's possible. And that shows our systemic fear of power because it's so systemic. It's at the deep-rooted, anyone who, you know, absolute power, finish the quote for me, Lord Acton, absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. Yeah. So if there's no checks and balances on that power, we give in to my desires to shape reality, my desire for control, my desire to influence others for me. And it's so systemic that basically in the 21st century, we're hugely, hugely suspicious of power, especially in Australia. A writer, philosopher, French philosopher, they're always French, Foucault said, those who have power use knowledge or information to reinforce their position of power. Do you want to understand what the gender language wars are about? They are about that. They are about, we feel that those in society who have positions of power are using knowledge or information to tell us what we ought to be like, and so we want to refute your use of gender language or your the way, as you name us, you are taking power from us. And we want to claim back power for ourselves by, that's what's going on then. The other way that you see it is basically, you see it again and again, that we're so frightened of power that now we've associated it with a gender of masculinity. And masculinity is the problem. So what do we do with power? We need authority. We need things to happen. We need things to get done. We need people to lead. Here's the interesting Christianity's take on power. Christianity recognizes the need for power. And it actually thinks it's a good thing. I don't know if that's shocking for you. It actually thinks power is a good and great thing. Jesus' words at the end of Matthew's gospel, which we were defining for how we should think about him from this point forward, were all authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. That is a claim for absolute totalitarian power. That is a claim that says, I will brook no dissent. No one can go against me in any sphere. All authority on heaven and earth has been given to me, and the person who gave it to me, he's God the Father. He says, yeah, power. I've got it all. You've got nothing. But here's the question. How does Jesus wield that power? Remember the three things I raised up as power? Getting things done, conforming reality to your vision of reality, controlling others, influencing others, or trying to get power to control yourself, influence your own freedom. Well, I want to take you to a scene in the Bible that's all about a power confrontation. Jesus has been praying with his disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Judas has betrayed Jesus to the Roman and Jewish authorities, and they come to arrest him. John chapter 18. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and went across the Kidron Valley. On the way, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place, because Jesus had often met his disciples there. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Sorry, there we go. Jesus, knowing that all was about to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it that you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas, the traitor, was standing with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. He asked them, "Who it is that you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. Jesus said, answered, "I told you I am he. If you are looking for me, then let these men go." It's a fascinating passage. See, who is Jesus? The English translations say, "I am he." More literally, he just says, "I am," which is exactly how God in the Old Testament described himself. He says, "I am." A recent study showed that there are two trillion galaxies in the world. That's 20 times more galaxies than scientists previously thought. So they've miscounted by a factor of 20. Can't trust scientists these days. In John's eyewitness account about Jesus, he constantly says that Jesus is the creator, the one who was God in eternity, who wielded power to create a galaxy of 2 trillion galaxies. Now, it's a big claim, and I don't have time to defend it now. And Jesus makes this declaration in this situation. He says, "I am." And what happens as he declares his power? What do the soldiers do? Men of power and authority, men who are under the Romans. What do they do? Verse 6. They fall to the ground. They can't help it. Just from him declaring who he is. That's how much power he's got. They fall to the ground. But notice how he wields the power. If you read through the narrative, he goes out to the soldiers looking for me. He's about to be arrested, but he does what? He asks them what they want. He then goes on to demand that the soldiers come and let the others go, which they do. When you read the scene carefully, who's wielding all the power? Jesus, complete and total power. And the soldiers just do what he wants. Here's the question, though. What does he do with his power? I can't quite read it on that screen. I've lost not one of those who gave to me. And they said, what does he do with his power? Then Simon Peter drew a sword, struck it, the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. Servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me?" Then the detachment of soldiers with its commanders and Jewish officials arrested Jesus. See, Jesus has all that power. And what does he do with it? He heals the man. Another Matthew's gospel tells us he heals the man whose ear was cut off. He lets himself be arrested. He lets himself be put on trial. He doesn't say anything in his trial. He doesn't defend himself initially at all. He just is silent as all the accusations. He lets himself be taken away and crucified. This is a man who stopped storms with a single word. This is a man who raised people from the dead. What does he do with his power? Well, he tells you here in verse 11, "Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me?" What is the cup? The cup in the Old Testament is God's judgment on the misuse and abuse of power between human beings. It's God's judgment on the way people have treated each other, which is always a misuse of power and authority. The cup contains God's anger from every time that a man beats a woman. It contains God's anger at every totalitarian regime. It contained God's anger at all kind of power exercise to gain more riches and greed and influence and reduce people to mere economic units, which happened in the ancient world just as it happened now. And Jesus says, "I'm going to drink that cup of God's anger down on the cross so that he can forgive us, restore us, heal us, bring us back into friendship with God." See, here's the God who exercises power. How? At cost to himself. So he's arrested. Does he gain more control? No, he gives up control. Does he bend reality to his needs? No, he bends himself to our needs. Does he act for his freedom? or for ours. See, Jesus wielded power to change reality, not for his good or for his freedom, but the Bible's message is for ours. And this understanding of power wielded this way has changed the world. Tom Holland, he's an ancient historian, but actually he's an interesting guy. He wrote an article, Why I Was Wrong About Christianity. And he talks about these ancient people like Caesar. And he says they're giant carnivores. He says they are terrifying. He talks about one group of Greek people, I think, don't know how to pronounce this, the Leonidas. These people, he said, practiced a peculiarly murderous form of eugenics. They trained their young to kill uppity Ushimitsin by night. So they trained their children to kill tribes of people they didn't like. He talks about Caesar, who went in and conquered France, Gaul, who killed more than 1 million people and enslaved 1 million more. That's how power was wielded in the ancient world. And this is why he says I was wrong about Christianity. He says, where does their understanding of power come from? It didn't come from the Enlightenment, he discovers. The more he read, he said, it doesn't come from the Enlightenment. It came from Christianity. Here's what he said. He said, in the ancient world, it was the role of gods who laid claim to ruling the universe to uphold its order by inflicting punishment, not to suffer it themselves. The notion that a god might have suffered torture and death on a cross was so shocking as to appear repulsive. Familiarity with the biblical narrative of the crucifixion has dulled our sense of just how completely novel a deity Christ was. And he says, this has changed the world we live in. And finally, people are starting to recognize that. See, imagine if we exercise power in this way for others at cost to ourselves, in government, in the corporate arena, in our homes, in our public places. How would that change the world? Italian philosopher Marcello Pera says this: without the Christian vision of the human person, our political life is doomed to become the mere exercise of power. And our encounter with the other, and he goes on to list the downtrodden, the poor, the weak, the people we don't agree with, can only deteriorate into violence and manipulation. He's not a Christian. He's an agnostic. But he's saying Christianity brings something to the table about power that is exercised for the other.